Coffee Roasters, open in Pioneer Square and SLU for takeout and soon indoor seating. Order coffee and more at elmcoffeeroasters.com. You're looking for a place to live in the fall with student-friendly amenities, spectacular views, and that's walking distance to campus? Check out the M Seattle. They are the only student living high-rise near UW, and they recently dropped their prices on all their floor plans. Visit themseattle.com for more info. Hi everyone, welcome back to Quarantine. I'm your host Beth, here for more of my experience of quarantine, where I have conversations and talk about issues going on in the world, as well as stories about people's experiences during this time. I hope everyone is taking care and spending extra time grounding themselves. These past few weeks with the Derek Chauvin trials happening regarding the murder of George Floyd and another black man being shot by the police this past week. And I wanted to take a second to say his name, Dante Wright. Justice for Dante Wright. We had a conversation last week about anti-Asian racism when we spoke with Deb. I'm excited to share the podcasting space today with Dr. Amy Zhang. She is a resident physician and MD, also has an MBA, as well as an Asian American woman. And she's here today to share her own experience in the past year as an Asian American woman in Seattle and her own thoughts about how we can be better allies as non-Asian people, specifically white people and those who don't have education about anti-Asian racism in the US, ways that this is present in society. Like we talked about last week with Deb, this is a conversation we all need to be having, as well as, you know, the conversation around Black Lives Matter. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Amy Zhang.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Before we get started, I just want to say that this is a safe and non-censored space, so please come as you are. I'm so happy to have you here to talk about your own personal experience as an Asian American woman. Yeah, so have you ever been on a podcast before?
Once, which was directly recorded from Zoom. And that was it.
Oh. Yeah, I've done that a few times where we literally just use the audio from Zoom, which is, it kind of works because you don't have to edit it, so it's like laid on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it's just another way we have to adjust life in pandemic era. Okay, so to get us started, I want to get to know you a little bit better. We talked a little bit before we started recording, but I want to hear about what a day in the life of Amy is like. Do you want to talk about where you work, what you've studied, which, as we talked about before, is as long as my left arm?
Mm-hmm. So I'm originally from the Northeast, and then basically I'm a resident physician at the University of Washington, and I moved out here to Seattle for a residency, basically. So in order to get into medicine, basically what you have to do is graduate from college with a bachelor's degree, so that's at least 4 years of undergraduate study, and then you have to go to med school. So there's around 100 of them in the country, and the class sizes are around 100 at each place. So it's a pretty competitive process. So then after you graduate from med school, then in order to become an independently practicing physician, you have to first do residency, which varies in length depending on what specialty you choose to do. I chose to go into anesthesiology, so that means I have to do 4 years of residency. And then once you're done with residency or fellowship, then you can be what's called an attending physician, which is an independently practicing physician. So right now as a resident, I don't really have that much free time, and my typical day is spent in the hospital around 6 or 6:30 a.m. all the way until sometime in the evening if I get off of work. And then at that point, I basically go home, maybe eat, study, and then sleep.
Right.
Yeah. And then in terms of my own path, I also ended up getting an MBA in the middle of med school. So the reason why I originally went into medicine is because I'm from a lower income background. And then when you're from a low income background, your family obviously has issues getting some of the essentials, including healthcare. And that actually ends up turning into a relatively big thing that affects your life a lot when you're not a perfectly healthy young individual. So that was why I originally went into medicine, because I was hoping to, you know, improve the healthcare system, improve healthcare access eventually. And then once I started med school and once I like got a better sense of the role of med students and the role of physicians in medicine and in the current US healthcare system, then I realized I wanted to play a bigger role. And I figured that getting an MBA, getting some more leadership experience, learning a bit more about policies and administration might help me in that further down my career, which is why I went for the MBA.
So how many more years of residency do you have left then?
So I'm a third year resident, and then anesthesia requires 4 years. So I'll be done in one more year. And in my case specifically, I don't plan on doing a fellowship immediately after residency. So I would be practicing as an attending in, I guess, summer/fall of 2022.
Okay, and what hospital are you doing your residency at right now?
So I'm currently at the University of Washington, which is a fairly large hospital system. Before you graduate, you enter something called the National Residency Match Program, where you're applying to residency, you're interviewing at a lot of places, you have to like turn in a personal statement and letters of recommendation and all that. And it's a competitive process. You either get a residency spot, which you are then obligated to go to, or you're unlucky and then you don't get a spot and then you either change careers or you go into the match process again the next year.
Wow. That is a toss up.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm thankful you got a spot.
Open since 2015, Elm Coffee Roasters is devoted to high quality coffee that's easy to brew at home and a joy to drink. At their roastery and cafe in Pioneer Square, Seattle, Elm obsessively roasts small batches of coffee that they source with a focus on sustainable practices that lift up the whole supply chain and protect the future of the coffee plant. Elm's goal is to make a truly exceptional cup of coffee, an experience you look forward to every day. Cafes in Pioneer Square and SLU open now for takeout and soon dine-in service. Please use code PODCAST at elmcoffeeroasters.com for 15% off your next order.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, that's a good transition into the conversation we're going to have today about anti-Asian sentiment, anti-Asian racism that has been increasingly more prominent, not saying it did not exist before, but is increasingly more prominent since the beginning of this pandemic and the shooting that occurred 3 weeks ago in Atlanta. So you have written two op-eds about your experience as an Asian American woman, and you have yourself experienced hate crimes just out and about on the streets. So I'm just going to let you talk about your the experience that you had, and we will talk more about how the institution you're working at handles these incidents, as well as your own thoughts on how people can be better allies for Asian Americans and Asian immigrants.
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, as an Asian American woman, it means a lot to get to talk about how I feel as an Asian American, because oftentimes people invoke the model minority stereotype to try to silence us, and people don't really pay that much attention to issues that affect Asian Americans and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that much. So that's kind of frustrating. And then there's also the fact that, you know, oftentimes there is the stereotype that we're supposed to be submissive and passive and quiet. And people certainly try to reinforce that as well, not necessarily within the Asian community, but just in terms of American society in general.
And Seattle's like culture as well.
Yeah.
The passivity of Seattle culture.
For sure. Yeah. Like I think for most Asian American women, we've definitely experienced, you know, the jokes that people make against Asians, the racist jokes basically that are okay to make in public school and high school. And it seems like we are one of the very few minorities where it's still politically correct to just say racist things and to make racist jokes about. Mm-hmm. And then like most Asian American women, we've been targeted for yellow fever before, like where, you know, there's guys who are non-Asian who almost exclusively try to date Asian Americans, mm-hmm. or try to sleep with Asian American women because
of that intersectionality between sexism and racism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because they think that, you know, Asian American women are supposed to be submissive or supposed mm-hmm. to fit gender roles. And then we're also supposed to be this very hypersexualized demographic. And then because we're not white or because we're not the predominant ethnicity or race in the U.S., mm-hmm. people don't necessarily see us as fully human. So then they kind of just view us as times as a sex object. And then the history of this is so old as well. Like, a lot of people know about the Chinese Exclusion Act. A lot of people have heard of the Chinese Exclusion Act, but they don't know about something else called the Page Act of 1875, which actually predated that. And basically, this was a law that severely limited immigration of Chinese women to the United States by citing the assumption that most Chinese women immigrating to the United States were prostitutes, even though they were not. And then the fact that this is the justification, the fact that this is the assumption, really leads to a very long history of this hypersexualization of and fetishization of Asian women.
Yeah, I feel like it's perpetuated too by the porn industry.
Yeah. And then subsequently, you also have things like, you know, American soldiers fighting more recent wars in Asian battlefronts, basically like World War II, the Vietnam War, Korean War, wars in the Philippines, where anytime where you have war, a lot of civilians are going to be victims of things like sexual violence, like rape. And then there's also going to be a lot of civilians who are affected financially and economically. And then they might have to turn to things like survival sex work, where you're in a very economically challenging situation and you're basically engaging in sex work because, yeah, like other job options aren't available and they need to eat, mm-hmm. and things like that.
Right.
So I've definitely felt those before and have had guys like joke about things like that before or be interested in me romantically or sexually for those reasons before. Some of it is also pretty obscene, like they say things about how your genitals are a certain way or slanted, mm-hmm. because they think, you know, Asian slanted eyes, why not slanted other things? And then the thing that most directly affected me happened basically relatively recently in March of 2020. And like you alluded to, a lot of people, myself included, come to Seattle and we think that it's going to be a very diverse and a very progressive city. So mm-hmm. we assume that people aren't going to be very blatantly racist. Right. When the COVID-19 pandemic went underway and when there were a lot of jokes going around about the Kung Flu or the Wuhan virus, when there were a lot of politicians, including our president at the time, Donald Trump, blaming China for the COVID-19 pandemic, there was definitely a lot of fear around the fact that Asians, Chinese Americans, Asian Americans were going to be targeted and kind of scapegoated because of this pandemic and because of this, you know, incendiary rhetoric. And that stuff has mostly been true and borne out with statistical evidence afterwards. So,
and people don't know that. I mean, I feel like since the Atlanta shooting, that was one of the first incidents that was covered on national news.
Yeah.
And that was following a year into the pandemic.
Yeah. And at the time, basically, you know, even in this context where healthcare workers were kind of venerated and everyone was clapping for healthcare heroes in Seattle every single night, healthcare workers of Asian descent were still being targeted, and people of Asian descent were still being targeted.
And especially in Seattle, I feel like Asians make up a big portion of the healthcare workers.
Yeah.
Because there is such a big population of Asian people here.
We do. As an aside, like Asian Americans, we make up a large proportion of healthcare workers, but we disproportionately make up an even larger proportion of healthcare workers who end up dying from COVID. So basically what happened in Seattle was in March of 2020, I was on night shift at Harborview Medical Center. And then for us, the night shift on weekdays started at 5 p.m. This was pretty shortly after the pandemic went underway. And this is before everyone was wearing masks all the time.
I loved that.
Yeah.
So awesome.
I mean, mm-hmm. at the time, basically, it's also interesting that you're saying so awesome as someone who appears to be a white woman, because at the time it was almost exclusively Asians who were wearing masks, if at all. And around that time, like, the fact that people were wearing masks was also raised as a risk of making us stand out more as Asians. And there had also recently been a video in New York of a woman in the subway system who was wearing a mask and then ended up getting assaulted by people who blamed her for spreading COVID, even though she probably wasn't wearing a mask because she was sick.
Right.
So basically,
to protect others.
Yeah.
It's like such a huge part that anti-maskers ignore.
Yeah. So basically, in March of 2020, while I was on Harborview night shift, which started at 5 p.m., I decided to walk to work instead of driving to work, because that meant I would be walking in the afternoon. And then with the kind of hours that we as residents work, we don't usually see the sun that much. Like, we don't usually get that much exposure to sunlight. We're in the hospital before dawn. We're out of the hospital after sunset, especially in Seattle. So I decided to walk to work in the afternoon because I thought that would be a fairly safe time to walk. I wasn't wearing a mask because I didn't want to draw attention to the fact that I was Asian. And I was wearing scrubs because, honestly, that was just more convenient. And then when I got pretty close to Harborview, like about a block away, there was a guy who was standing on the street corner, a white man, if I want to be specific, who was also taller than me, as most men are, who was standing on the street corner. And I passed by him pretty closely when I was walking to the hospital. Like, there was still a few feet between us, but it was mm-hmm. distance he could easily close if he wanted to, and he could easily reach me and touch me if he wanted to. And then as I'm passing by, he just starts muttering things like, "Fuck you, China, for giving us smallpox." And then as I kept walking, things got a little bit scarier, because then he started following me. And as he was following me, he also got more and more agitated and more angry, and he just started screaming things at me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Amy, what were you thinking when this was happening?
I was nervous and I was scared, but I think part of it was also, things were happening so quickly that I didn't fully realize how scary things could have been until much later on.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I remember the most that he was yelling, because of how graphic it was and because of how suggestive and threatening it was, "Fuck you, Yuke, fuck you in the ass." And at the time, this was also before we really had visitor restrictions in hospitals. So simply going into Harborview doesn't necessarily mean he's going to stop following me, because he can still follow me into the hospital. But I basically hurried up. I didn't run because I didn't want to trigger him or stimulate him to follow me and to chase after me. But I walked into the hospital and I'm like sort of doing a fast walk, and I feel pretty fortunate that he decided not to follow me and that things didn't escalate to a physical level. And then I went to work. I was kind of shaken up for a bit. And then after I was no longer in immediate danger, then I was angry. I was really outraged. This sounds kind of very healthcare worker mindset almost, but one of the reasons why I was really angry was the fact that he had targeted me and harassed me right before the start of my shift as opposed to after the end of my shift. So now this was going to affect my readiness to start taking over patient care as soon as I started. And I felt bad for my patients. I felt bad for my colleagues because, you know, I was emotionally distracted and I was stressed out and I was scared. I was angry. Part of the reason why I care a lot about what kind of emotional state I'm in and how well I can think when I'm at work is because I'm in medicine, and more specifically, I'm in anesthesiology, which is a specialty where things can change. Like, I mean, when we talk about things that can kill a patient in the OR, there's a lot of, like, your job as an anesthesiologist is basically to be very vigilant of everything. You pay attention to the tones indicating what their oxygen saturation is. You pay attention to their heart rate. You pay attention to their blood pressure. And these are little things that you need to catch pretty quickly. We work with the airway. That's something that, like, people often think of the surgeons as being the stars in the OR. There's almost nothing a surgeon can do or fix that can change whether a person lives or dies faster than what we can do and be in charge of. So we're talking not even on the scale of minutes. We're talking about, like, situations where seconds count. Like, when we intubate a patient after they're completely induced, from the time that you open the patient's mouth to the time that we insert the breathing tube and they're fully intubated, if you do it well and if you have a smooth intubation, that takes less than a minute, and that's a life-saving procedure. So it really matters that you're in the right mindset and you're able to process a lot of things very quickly. You're able to synthesize things and you're able to, like, manage and evaluate situations very, very quickly. And being in an emotionally distracted mindset, especially a mindset where I was at a very, very, very heightened level of stress, is not very contributory to that.
Personally attacked.
So I was kind of fortunate in the sense that the way staffing worked out, I didn't have to go into an OR immediately, and I didn't have to immediately be, like, the only person at the anesthesia end in an OR. And I actually did get a decent amount of time to kind of decompress and de-stress before actually taking over patient care. That wasn't necessarily by design. That seemed to just be how staffing worked out that day, that I didn't have to immediately take over that. So that was definitely fortunate. But then after things escalated more in terms of the pandemic and in terms of anti-Asian violence, after the shootings in Atlanta where Asian women were targeted by Long, who was the shooter, after including the murder of 8 people, including 6 Asian women, then it really hit home a lot more that this could have escalated. The only reason why I got out of this more or less unscathed was because the guy who was being aggressive towards me didn't escalate things to a physical level. He probably wasn't carrying a gun that day, and he probably didn't have a knife on him, and he didn't shoot me. And that could have easily been me. I've looked into the stuff about the victims, because I think even though the sheriff of one of the counties in that area decided to focus on and humanize the shooter by saying, you know, he had a bad day, he was at the end of his rope, and this was what he did, instead of talking about the victims and the full and rich lives and personalities that they had, I felt that I should read more into them. And one of the victims was a 33-year-old woman who had decided to treat herself to a spa day that day. She didn't work there, and what was supposed to be, you know, a nice relaxing time ended up resulting in her murder. So it really hit home that, you know, this could have easily been someone like me. And also, I have family who have worked in spas and in similar settings before. I've also hung out in similar settings before because they've been working there. And it really made me feel very vulnerable because this could have easily been me. And this didn't happen in the middle of nowhere. This happened in Atlanta, which is a large metropolitan area, and which is generally considered fairly progressive.
Of of the most metropolitan areas in Seattle, I feel like. It's like a very busy area by yeah. all of you.
So basically, you know, the fact that things have happened in Atlanta and the fact that, you know, I was harassed in Seattle definitely made me feel like I'm a lot more on edge. I think one of the changes immediately after being racially harassed by this white man that I implemented in my life was that I no longer walked outside that much. I exclusively drove to and from work, even though the way UW is set up is that we have to pay for our own parking. We get charged about $9 a day for parking, which is a lot when you're on a resident salary. It's something that's affected me financially, and it's also something that affects me day to day. You don't necessarily realize how much, like, you know, you go outside from time to time for spur of the moment things. Like, the other day I decided to make a trip to the gym because I had some free time, and that's a 20-minute walk to and from. So that's really 40 minutes. And then while I was walking, since I'm walking alone,
right,
about 10 minutes into it, I start wondering, you know, did I just make a really egregious mistake? Is this the day that I'm finally going to get smashed in the face with a hard object by someone in a way that knocks out my teeth and requires me to get surgery to fix the damage? Because that's what happened fairly recently this year to a UW affiliate. And she was also an Asian woman, and a guy in ID smashed her in the face with a sock with a hard object inside it. And that's what happened to her. There's so many spur-of-the-moment grocery runs that you can no longer go on without worrying about whether or not this is the day you're going to get targeted.
Right.
And the number of attacks in Seattle have gone up. There's the recent arrest of Mr. Hamner, who was threatening and who was behaving aggressively towards young Asian American women on multiple occasions, including young Asian women with children with them at the time. And I don't know if you've interacted with kids very much, but it's a very vulnerable situation to be in when you're an adult with a child who you may need to protect, and you're being targeted by someone.
Oh my gosh, yes. I have little siblings, and I babysit.
Yeah, and they can't run away that quickly, too. So things in Seattle are definitely feeling more dangerous, and it also feels anger-inducing when people talk about how they don't want to discuss politics at work, and then issues of race, issues of racism, issues of sexism, issues of bias are too political to discuss at work because...
Right. As if that's your...
Right.
Your experiences.
I mean, it also feels very different when you're a minority because you can choose not to talk about politics at work. You can choose not to show your political affiliation. You can choose to downplay these things so people don't target you for these reasons. I can't just take off my race and my gender and leave that at home and leave that in places where it's convenient. Leave that, like, hide that when I'm traveling in areas where I don't know what kind of random stranger is going to target me or attack me because of my race and gender. It's not a danger that I can just put down and not worry about. This is something that's constant. So that's something that I think a lot of my friends, acquaintances, colleagues who are allies and who are not minorities don't fully understand. To some extent, I think all women understand this because we know that, you know, half the population is larger than us, physically stronger than us, and able to overpower and outrun us if they wanted to. And so, like, you know, from a young age, even as women, we're taught to sort of look out for things and to care about our own safety in a way that men aren't. But I don't think it's something that a lot of my allies fully understand.
Right. I mean, thank you for explaining that in further detail, because I think the best way to understand is to listen and hear about other people's stories, especially when it comes to being a woman. Like you said, women all understand what it's like to be under the male gaze and also be harassed. I think like something like 93% of the population of women are harassed by men. So
we know that these racists, these aggressive bigots are targeting more vulnerable populations. There's statistics out from Stop AAPI Hate that Asian women are reporting these bias incidents and these racist hate crimes at 2.3 times the level that Asian American men are reporting them. So they're definitely targeting vulnerable people. And as we've seen in recent news as well, you know, a lot of these attacks have been against elderly individuals. So they're definitely targeting the more vulnerable members of the AAPI community that seem less likely to be able to fight back.
Thank you for sharing that statistic. That's very interesting and also something I did not know. Let's talk about the institutions and how they are handling this. Has UW / the hospital, have they been showing solidarity with their Asian American employees and students? Have they been making it known that they are aware of this and providing resources for you guys, or is it kind of like fend for yourself?
So I think the University of Washington is somewhat reflective of the rest of Seattle. And I don't mean that necessarily in a good sense. I think Seattle is a lot more racist than a lot of white people may realize because they're not the targets of these racist incidents. They don't notice all the microaggressions that happen from day to day. They're not the ones who are talking to other minority colleagues who, you know, people feel safe sharing with them the fact that, you know, when they sit on a bus, sometimes people in Seattle who seem super progressive and whatnot move away from them, refuse to sit next to them, and things like that. So I think to a certain level, we have to acknowledge the fact that at UW, even though most people are not blatantly racist, at least the staff are not blatantly racist, there are a lot of little microaggressions that are going on from day to day, and which are going on unchecked. Nobody is being held accountable for them. And then a lot of us individuals from marginalized communities or from minority groups are quiet about them, except amongst ourselves, because there aren't really safe spaces to really talk about this, to really share this. And we also don't know if how our colleagues will take this, whether or not they're going to treat us like we're being oversensitive. So that's part of it. For a lot of us Asian Americans, we've dealt with situations where people have gotten our names wrong. Like, that happens fairly frequently. And it's kind of amazing because you're like, oh, so you can sort out Jakob from Jacob, from Jake, or from Jason, but you can't really tell a Sharon and a Michelle apart. Like, these names are a lot more dissimilar. And then I've also had some colleagues who are very different in height from another colleague that they've been called the wrong name for. And you're just like, how does this even happen? Like, it's not even a matter of they look facially similar. They're literally more than a foot difference in height. So there's a lot of little incidents like that all the time. In my case, I have a different official name than my nickname, which is Amy. And it's kind of annoying because a lot of people will insist on trying to call me by my official name multiple times. They'll insist on trying to get it right, even after I've told them that I prefer going by my nickname, which is Amy. And then in that case, the thing you really notice or the thing you really think about is for all of our emphasis on preferred names and for how straightforward it is for someone to just refer to a James as a Jimmy and to just accept that instead of questioning it, we get a lot of pushback when we try to even take ownership of our own names and what we prefer to be called. So that is also kind of frustrating. In terms of UW itself, to its credit, it did release a statement of solidarity and a statement condemning racist incidents and condemning bias, including specifically talking about the shootings in Atlanta and talking about anti-Asian incidents. But this was released more than 2 days after the shootings in Atlanta occurred. A lot of departments decided to take it upon themselves to release a statement denouncing what happened and condemning what happened as well, around the same time or maybe before UW released that statement, because they felt like it wasn't being said fast enough. And I do think these statements of solidarity are very helpful in letting us know that we are acknowledged, that people aren't going to gaslight us about our experiences, and they are going to at least pay lip service to it and hopefully address it. My own department has not released a statement. After talking to some faculty individually, it seems like the decision behind that was because they wanted to go with the overall UW statement. And because they didn't think spending the time to release these statements was going to be more effective than actually taking action within the department and trying to address issues within the department itself, which is a mm-hmm. fair take on it. I can see where they're coming from. I respect that. I understand that. I disagree with it, but I can understand.
I was gonna say, how do you feel about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I can understand their logic, and I can understand their reasoning behind it. And I think in the end, this is something we may end up agreeing to disagree on.
I hope they take action. I feel like people will jump to speak rather than act because they know they're not actually going to act. And I think that's why the statements of solidarity, as Deb said in the other interview, she talked about the statement made by UW and kind of called BS on it because she was like, UW does say a lot about racism and then does nothing to show their support in their actions. So I hope your department takes that seriously.
I think the individuals in my department who are in charge of equity, diversity, and inclusion are very good people, and I have faith behind them. So I'm hopeful about that point. I do think that UW overall and a lot of institutions overall, starting with Black Lives Matter, have not been paying enough attention to racism and to bias, and they're sort of playing catch up at this point. So I think there is a lot more work to do in terms of that. I think part of it is that individuals need to be more open to acknowledging and addressing racial privilege or male privilege.
Or just being open to the conversation.
Exactly. Being open to the conversation, not viewing this thing as something that's too political to discuss or too political to address at work. And I do think that UW can certainly put a lot more effort and action behind their words. Like, if they instituted like widespread institutional policies and really publicized those policies against racism and against bias, if they established policies regarding how we are going to deal with like patients or visitors who may exhibit bias, and if they made sure that all staff were fully trained in this, if they promoted resources for support regarding anti-racism, regarding individual communities that have been affected by racism, if they would take time to provide us with bystander intervention training, that would be very important. If they actually addressed their own hiring and promotion and employment practices, because there is such a thing known as the bamboo ceiling, which is where, you know, a Harvard Business School, I think it was Harvard Business School study, found that Asian Americans were one of the least likely groups to be promoted to management. And that may be attributed to stereotypes like the fact that, or stereotypes that as Asians we're more mechanical, we're more robotic, we're not capable of leadership qualities, we're not capable of creative thought. That might be part of it, although, you know, we are individuals and we can be very assertive and we can speak our minds if you allow us to. And we can be very capable in terms of creativity.
And as leadership. If like so much of the art, food, music doesn't come from Asia.
Yeah, I know. Like several of the great world changing inventions came out of Asia, but we're not capable of creativity. So there's definitely things like that that they can certainly work on. And I think on an individual level, it's very important for people to be open to these conversations, to people being willing to address their own biases and examine their own microaggressions, to try to view things maybe even through the lens of someone else who has a very different identity. Like, I don't think my white coworkers were necessarily thinking about how much of your life is affected if all of a sudden you are no longer safe to walk outside. Yeah, and to clarify, I still do go outside. It's just scarier when I do.
I didn't think you didn't. It's just scary the amount of emotional labor and energy that goes into just thinking about the things that could happen to you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's anxiety. That's a lot of worry and paranoia that you're having to battle.
I do think something else that people might need to consider, or a bit of nuance that people may need to, you know, take into account when they're trying to show support for minoritized individuals, is you shouldn't necessarily put someone on the spot and ask them how they're doing and ask them if they're okay if you don't have that level of comfort or closeness between you two. Because that is asking a very personal question, and you are kind of asking them to be vulnerable to you. Instead, what you should try to do is you should try to be a safe individual who's available for them and try to indicate that you are available to listen. You aren't going to try to speak over someone, and that you're not going to be like hypersensitive and be someone who they in turn have to comfort over their own mistreatment because now you feel bad.
Yeah, I feel like that was a reckoning that a lot of white people were having to have, especially this summer with the Black Lives Matter movement, where it's like, not about you. It does not need to come back to you. And also, if you don't know this person on a personal level that you wouldn't normally ask them about their day, you're othering them and creating even more tension.
As an aside, in healthcare especially, I think this is something we really need to pay attention to, because you're working with vulnerable populations. You're working with patients. And Hamner, for example, the man who was arrested for hate crimes against Asian American women, there's a rumor going around that he works at the VA hospital. I mean, it matters in healthcare because there actually are differences in terms of healthcare outcomes, in terms of mortality and morbidity based on people's patients' races and ethnicities. So this actually has very real outcomes.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important to understand how these things are individual, and there are like certain microaggressions that and biases that we, okay, white people perpetuate. And it's so important for people to do their own like work on that, but also understand that this is institutionalized systemically in all areas of society.
Yeah. I think one of the more problematic things about Seattle, as opposed to some other areas, is you have a lot of individuals who, you know, they're well-intentioned. They believe they're very progressive. And that means they also don't acknowledge the possibility that they may be perpetuating these microaggressions. They may be perpetuating biases. I've had some people talk about how, you know, they don't think staff members, without even naming individual names, like they don't think staff members at this institution could be problematic because this is one of the most diverse and progressive institutions and things like that. And it's like, you know, if you don't even address if you don't even acknowledge the possibility there is a problem, how can you ever hope to effectively address it?
Just the fact that we have to say the most diverse, the most inclusive, is a sign that that there are issues, because the reason it's diverse and inclusive is because the majority of the population is white people here in Seattle.
Yeah. It's very interesting talking to different colleagues too, depending on who's around, because then, you know, it's mostly my white peers or my white supervisors or colleagues who say things about how they think, you know, the picture is so rosy, and how they think, you know, Seattle is such a nice place, how it's so progressive and diverse. And then you talk to some peers from like minoritized backgrounds who, while they may also agree that Seattle is a nice place, they'll also talk about how, like, you know, they were surprised at how much racism.
Okay. Oh my gosh, Amy, thank you so much for all of this content that you just produced, especially as it relates to your own life and your own trauma. That's very brave of you to come on and share. And thank you so much for reaching out to me. And I hope you have a good rest of your week.
That wraps up this week's conversation. Thank you everyone for tuning in. Amy is not only a doctor, but she also writes as well. She is a jack of all trades. And you can find her op-eds in the link in the bio. And also you can follow Amy on Twitter at YZHANGMD1. Thanks guys for tuning in. Make sure to follow me on Instagram at UWQuarantee, and make sure to practice lots of grounding and self-care this week. Thanks always. Peace and love.